This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
You're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
With us on America Trends is Adam Veltz, and he's written a book called The End of Eden, and it's about climate change, though he likes to think of it as climate weirdness in a way, and it's really about the fact that we are so centered on ourselves in the process of climate change, yet we've got more ways technologically and otherwise to protect ourselves and shield ourselves than those with whom we inhabit this planet. And I'm talking about some of these species, some that you can see, some that you can't, that are millions of years old. And you say that we really need to think about them to truly understand the predicament that we're in.
First of all, Larry, thanks for chatting with me. I really appreciate talking about the book and its subject and getting the message out to as many people as I can. I think when we talk about climate change, obviously there's a lot about that in the news media. We tend to think only of ourselves, only of our own species, Homo sapiens. You know, what does it mean for us? What's it going to do to our economies, the societies? What's it already doing to our economies and societies? A lot of people nowadays are so nature alienated that they forget that we share the planet with millions of species, and these wild species are also all being affected by climate change or climate breakdown, as I prefer to call it. And I decided to write a book about it, you know, to turn the focus, let's say, away from Homo sapiens and, you know, towards these other species. And and that's what I've done. And I think it's really important to consider what's going on with these other species and not just, you know, focus on.
Yeah, well, in Time magazine, you wrote a piece, and I love the headline, Animals Don't Have AC. And you tell us that as much as we focus on ourselves and the impact that it's having already, fires, floods, storms, that wild nature is feeling 100 times more impact, and it's so overlooked. Explain to us what they are sensing, or give us one of your many case examples that you give in the book.
I think a lot of folks, you know, like on a hot day, a lot of folks think, oh, well, if they think about other species at all, they think, oh, well, these other species must have some way of handling this heat, right? I can go indoors, and if I'm wealthy enough and I live in a country with reliable power, I can go inside and I can turn on the AC and I can cool down. I just assume, well, all those birds and, you know, other animals, the plants, what have you, outdoors, they must have some way of dealing with this. The truth is a lot of these species don't necessarily have some way of dealing with the new increased temperatures, you know, we're seeing around the world. For example, I tell a story in the book of a bunch of birds that are dying out in warmer areas around the world, like the Mojave Desert in Southern California or in the Kalahari here in Southern Africa. I tell the story of birds that are quietly dying out with these increased daytime temperatures, not because they're getting heat stroke and dramatically falling down dead in large numbers, but because as temperatures increase, they're forced to spend more and more time during the day basically sitting in the shade and panting and doing nothing in order to cool their bodies down. And this means that they don't have enough time to go and find food for their nestlings, which means that their nestlings starve and die. And so a whole bunch of bird species around the world are quite rapidly but quite quietly disappearing from large areas that they previously occupied. Again, not because a giant heat wave or sort of heat stroke is dramatically killing thousands or millions of them all at once, but is making it increasingly difficult and in many cases impossible for them to breed successfully. So their species are dying out. So, you know, that's just one of many stories that I tell in the book. What I try to do with the book is through the stories of a whole bunch of different species all around the world, just illustrate the many different ways in which climate breakdown is affecting wild species. Telling these stories and explaining the sort of, let's say, the physical mechanisms behind them in language that your average intelligent person, you know, can understand. You know, you don't have to have a PhD in thermodynamics or in ecology to understand this book. No, I want folks to be able to come in from, you know, just sort of, you sort of, let's say, your intelligent regular person who reads books, let's be able to gain some insights, you know, into how this is the many different ways in which these changes are affecting wild species in the natural world.
Well, unfortunately, there are so many people who don't really take this issue as seriously as they need to. Do you think that by telling these stories about, say, the polar ice, that's going on in the bears and so forth, at least large organisms that people seem to really fasten onto. I worked for PBS for years and they love the nature programs. Do you think that that's a way into this issue that might otherwise escape people, that they just don't really seem to fasten onto it? Do you think telling the stories of these wonderful creatures might help to really drive the point home?
I think it does. I've had really interesting feedback from folks who've read the book. It's a challenging read, I think, for a lot of people because the news is not very good, right? Climate change, or as I said, climate breakdown, as I prefer to call it, is already having massive impacts on wild species and ecosystems around the world, and those impacts are only becoming more intense. So reading about that sort of stuff is quite challenging for a lot of people. It's not a happy-go-lucky kind of, whistling through the woods, whatever kind of a story. Mm-hmm. But the feedback that I've got from folks is really quite heartening. You know, a lot of people are like, man, you know, I now understand how this works. It makes me feel like less helpless. It makes me feel like more connected to this issue. You know, because I think for a lot of people, climate change is this like big, scary kind of issue. It's kind of everywhere and nowhere, you know, all at once. You know, it's not something that you can sort of touch sides with. It's not all that concrete to a lot of people, unless of course you know lived in New York City a few years ago and you got run over by Hurricane Sandy, and you sort of as I was at that time, then you start understanding, you know, part of it. But I think what's really empowering about this book is it gives all these examples and it sort of explains why these species are being affected in all these different ways. And folks actually understand the sort of mechanisms and how this plays out, like I said, and that makes them feel that that climate change is less fuzzy. It's now something that they can understand, and they can sort of like get their teeth into. And I think once you feel that way about an issue, even a very difficult big issue like this one, it makes you feel less powerless. It makes you feel less, you know, lost about the whole thing. So that's been really helpful to me, you know, and sort of validating, as I say, is that kind of feedback that I'm getting from a lot of people. You know, random people email me through my website and give me this kind of feedback. It's really great to see that, and that's really what I tried to do, and you know, I think I'm succeeding. You know, I'm not pretending that I'm going to change the mind of the fanatical anti-science sort of lunatics, in, you know, quite a few of whom are very, you know, prominent in the U.S., especially nowadays. You know, there's certain people that you're just never going to reach with any kind of, you know, reasoned storytelling or arguments. But I think by sort of, as I say, by flipping the perspective of this book away from us and, you know, onto, very squarely onto the natural world, it gives people a sort of new way of looking at the issue. And as I say, the feedback that I'm getting from people is that's actually been very useful to them, notwithstanding the fact that the book as a whole is actually quite challenging and the stories, most of them are not, you know, candy floss and roses.
I'm going to ask you to tell us another story, but I want to couch it in this sense. I had another naturalist on from the United States, yeah. University of North Carolina, and he wrote a book, and I had him on, and I'm trying to help people get the word out about climate weirdness in different ways.
Yeah.
And he was doing it through the lens of what is it that my daughter, who is now 19, will not see. And in a sense, you do that as well. The fact that we are squandering Eden, millions of years of evolution, that kids will not experience lots of what it is that we have enjoyed, and the Earth will be a much more fragile place going forward. So give us a story that you think combines somebody's passion for animals and for children and what they're going to be missing.
Well, you know, I can give an example that I mentioned. Well, look, there's loads of examples in the book, but I can give you an example that I mentioned in the book that's very, very close to home right now. And by close to home, I mean I'm sitting here in Cape Town in South Africa, you know, the southwestern corner of Africa here. And just down the road from me, literally a handful of miles, a very short drive down the road from me, we have a colony of African penguins, and these are incredible, very charismatic animals, right? They're black and white penguins. They waddle around on the beach. They're super cute. My kids are now 9 years old, and I say kids, plural, and they're the same age because they're triplets. I've taken them down to this penguin colony since they were very, very young, and they know these penguins. And they've even swum in the bay with penguins, swimming in the water right next to them and so on. They know these penguins. They love them. But these penguins are disappearing very, very rapidly. In fact, we're seeing a decline in the population of African penguins of somewhere to the order of around as much as 10% per year. And if you know anything about compound interest, that's incredibly fast. The African penguin at the moment is now at less than 2% of its historical numbers. They used to, 100 years ago, there were literally millions of them. We're down to the low tens of thousands now. And we're looking at losing the species entirely by 2035. That's 11 years away. That's before my girls are going to be 21 years old. The main reasons that's driving this massive drop of this population of this wonderful species, flightless bird that only occurs here in the southwestern part of Africa, is climate change causing massive variations in ocean temperatures. Before, ocean temperatures were quite predictable. There were certain patterns, you know, they went up and down in certain ways at certain times of the year. Now we're seeing ocean temperatures wildly oscillating in the areas where these penguins live. And that means that the fish that the penguins feed on are experiencing a wildly disrupted environment, which means some years their eggs don't hatch, the young don't grow in the right kind of way. Some years the fish all move hundreds of miles away from their normal place because the ocean temperature has changed, which means it's very, very difficult for penguins to find reliable food for their babies, you know, in the nest. And again, we're seeing just large numbers of penguins starving in certain years, you know, a very, very poor breeding success in a lot of years. And we're sitting here, you know, and combined with overfishing and poor management of fisheries, which is a huge problem around the world, you know, this is driving this amazing, amazing species that's literally right on my doorstep and that my kids have grown up, you know, seeing it and loving and knowing, is driving it into extinction before our very eyes. Year on year, these birds are just disappearing. I mean, when I was a youngster, there were probably 10 times as many penguins as there are now. You know, I'm literally watching this thing go extinct in my lifetime. And it's not abstract. It's real. It's right in front of me. It's right here, right now. And I think the point that I'm trying to make in the book is if you're anybody, anywhere on earth, and that includes if you're an urban person in the heart of a massive city like New York City, which I lived in for a while, you know, you can actually see these changes yourself. If you start paying attention to the wild species around you, and that can be just in your local urban park, you know, go and look at the flowering plants. See when they're flowering. See when they don't. Look at the butterflies. When do they come? Look at the birds. Look at the migrant birds. When do they come? When don't they come? I promise you, if you start paying attention to this stuff, even if you're not a professional biologist, even if you just become a self-taught, like, amateur naturalist going and looking at the birds and the bees and the what have you in your local park, you will soon see these changes with your very own eyes. And I think that to me is a sort of message that I'm also trying to get through is you actually, the changes in climate are triggering changes in the environment that are now so obvious to anybody that pays attention that you don't need to rely on the scientists to tell you what's going on anymore. You don't need to decide, oh, am I going to believe the scientists or am I going to believe the crazy pundits that are being funded by the oil industry on, you know, Fox News or whatever it is. You know, you no longer have to place trust in these other authorities. You can use your own eyes, your own ears, your own nose and see for yourself what's happening. You know, again, I promise you, if you just pay attention, within a small handful of years, you will see these changes with your very own eyes, and you will no longer doubt, you know, what's going on.
This is Adam Veltz. He's written the book, The End of Eden, Wild Nature in the Age of Climate Breakdown, and he's an old school naturalist who likes to dive into places full of living things. Bring me closer to my home and where many of my listeners are, that being in the New York area, the Adirondacks. And you have visited there time and again. You have seen a lot of things going on there. Things that, again, for example, about invasive insects that are more easily able to spread in devastating waves because of the milder, shorter winters. And what that means, they used to be more in the southern climes of the U.S. They're now moving into the Northeast, again, where many of us who listen to this podcast are. So explain to us what's happening in our own backyard.
I mean, there's two stories that I tell in the book that are relevant to that part of the world. Again, a part of the world that I lived in New York City for quite a number of years and traveled to a lot of those woodlands and spent time in the Adirondacks and in places like the Green Mountains and so on, and visited Maine a few times and those coastal forests up there. One of the stories I tell is of a tiny little critter. It's literally the size of a grain of rice. It's called the southern pine beetle. And this tiny little beetle used to be confined to the southeastern U.S. and the woodlands there, where it's just one tree munching or tree killing insect among many. But what's happened, again, very recently, we're talking the last 10, 15 years or so,
is winter minimum temperatures in a lot of the Northeast are not as low as they used to be. In other words, the winters are not getting as cold as they used to. And what that means is the southern pine beetle, this little insect, is able to move up from the southeastern U.S. and spread into these areas and survive the winters and therefore build up large populations in these areas. And this beetle likes to go for certain types of pine trees, particularly a species called a pitch pine, which I don't know if you know, the pine barrens of New Jersey, the sort of more towards the coastal areas of New Jersey, you get these, the famous pine barrens ecosystem. Well, I mean, those are dominated by pitch pine. That's the species of pine that really is the sort of keystone species of the pine barrens. Just in the last few years, we've seen just extraordinary tens of thousands of acres of pitch pines in the pine barrens get absolutely, you know, killed off by this surging population of southern pine beetle, a species that just, you know, certainly 20 years ago would never have been able to survive a winter in these areas, is now exploding, and it's completely transforming these ecosystems at a rapid rate. It's taking out the keystone species, killing them off in huge areas. And this beetle is now moving north. It's very recently been found in New Hampshire and Maine, and you know, it's moving up. And as it goes, so the forests get totally overhauled and totally transformed. And it's only one of many of these insects that are now being able to expand into these areas because of warming winters. I mean, another story that I tell in the book is of the so-called winter tick and how that's affecting moose populations in states like Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine. Because again, this is a species of tick that in the past had very, you know, moderate populations on moose, sort of afflicted moose fairly mildly. But now, as things are warming up, effectively what this means is the summer is getting longer. The falls are staying warmer longer. The springs are being warmer earlier. So the season, the length of the year in which these ticks can be active, and in other words, moving around and looking for a host, looking for an animal to hook onto, are now a few months longer than they were, again, just 25, 30 years ago. So what this means is these ticks have more time to hook on to moose. And once they've hooked onto a moose for the winter, then they can survive the winter. They don't get killed off in the cold because they, you know, they use the animal's body heat to survive. And what's happening now is tick loads on moose are so intense that in certain areas in Maine and so on, we're seeing 90% of young moose are being killed by these ticks because they're literally, and this is pretty gross, they're being exsanguinated. In other words, there's so many ticks on them that it's pulling so much blood out of the animals that they effectively, you know, starve and die. And again, this tick is an animal that's, you know, is a parasite that's been in these areas for time immemorial. You know, they've been affecting moose for who knows, hundreds of thousands, millions of years. But they, because the warm season has never been this long, they've never been able to build up their populations on moose in the way that we're seeing now. You know, and again, this is a massive change because moose, of course, are very big animals. And so they're ecosystem engineers in these northeastern ecosystems. And when you start knocking back the moose population because the ticks are exploding, that affects the whole ecosystem, right? Because moose eat a lot of vegetation, they trample a lot of vegetation, and when you take that away, it changes what we call the sort of disturbance regime in these woodlands, and there's a potential to completely transform them, and therefore affect the prospects of, you know, uncountable numbers of other species. You know, it has a total knock-on effect on the structure of that whole ecosystem. So again, you know, what I'm trying to say is all it takes is a tiny little increase in winter minimum temperature, which effectively liberates one little species of a bug or one little species of tick from a previous constraint, and that ultimately ends up changing an entire ecosystem really, really quickly. And that's what I want to get through to folks. You know, it's that these really rather subtle shifts can actually have massive knock-on effects. You know, we think, oh, like, what's 1 degree? You know, well, 1 degree is the difference between life and death for a little insect, you know. And if you sort of raise your winter minimum temperature by 1 degree and allow this insect to survive and thrive, it can, as I say, go on and, you know, effectively destroy entire woodlands, change entire ecosystems within just months, literally, in some cases. We're not talking decades or anything like that. It's a much shorter period of time.
Right. Well, you say that human society is completely reliant on the predictable functioning of these ecosystems, and we are pushing those ecosystems into unstable states, driving up uncertainty, pushing ourselves deeper and deeper into the unknown. So this gets back to we the people, which
right.
we care the most about. So tell us,
yes.
those impacts, we don't have these ticks all over our body, but there are yes. such impacts up and down the food chain, if you will. We like to think of ourselves as masters of the universe, the Anthropocene. We're at the top of the pile. But what does it mean for us? And what are we already seeing dramatically, for example, south of the equator, that should really be a lesson for those of us who are north of it?
Again, I think this is where it gets kind of hard for people to understand, right? Is the global ecosystem is a really complicated system, right? It has just uncountable numbers of moving parts, and there's all sorts of things that you know, you push one little part of the system in one place and it affects things, you know, in another place and so on. What I think, again, coming back to you know, what you quoted me as saying there, is that since human civilization came into being, which is roughly 10,000 years ago, right, when humans started being able to, you know, plow fields and sort of grow grains and sort of create settled agriculture, which resulted in us being able to create larger and larger settlements that became cities and reliably feed these and so on. In this 10,000 years since civilization started, essentially, we've had a very stable and predictable climate in general. And we've built our entire civilization around this predictability. All right. This might not be super obvious to people who live in cities and so on, but it's extremely obvious to farmers, for example, in the fields, or, you know, fisher people who know that, you know, they need to go to certain places at certain times of the year to catch certain kinds of fish. Right. Our entire civilization is reliant on agriculture, obviously, to feed us. And agriculture is entirely reliant on this factor of predictability in the ecosystem. You know, you plant your seed a certain kind of year because your time of year, because you expect a certain sort of amount of rain to fall, you know, if you're a corn farmer or whatever it is. I think what's kind of tough for people to understand is that scientists can't predict all the outcomes of climate change. We can't say, oh, well, you know, like 10 years from now, the climate in this particular town in wherever is going to be like this, right? The system is too complex to predict that kind of like granular change. But what we can say for sure is that we are making the system overall far less predictable and much more susceptible to extremes. We're making the chances of extreme downpours and rainfalls and flood events, for example, much higher. We're also making the chances of droughts much higher. We're making the chances of extreme weather events much higher around the world. And all of these things basically hurt this factor of predictability, which is really dangerous for us, right? Because our whole civilization relies on predictability. And as I say in the book, I think often people confuse influence with control. in a sense, you know, you talk about us as the masters of the universe. We have this massive influence on the planet, right? We're changing its climate. We're changing all of these things. We've plowed out the prairies. We've cut down the woodlands. We've fished out the seas. We're changing all these things. We have this massive influence on the planet, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a sort of paradoxical thing that the more influence we exert, the less control we have on the outcome. Mm. Because the more that we're pushing this complex system into unstable states, into unknown realms, and how we're sort of hurting its predictability. So just because we have more influence on the planet does not mean we have more control. In fact, what we're doing right now is more and more influence is resulting in less and less control. And this, I think, should be really concerning to anybody with half a brain cell to rub against another.
You've said that your research convinced you that these wild ecosystems around the world will not survive, but you also believe that despair over climate change is mostly unfounded. What is it that you are really feeling about the end of Eden? Is there a question mark there? Is it the end of Eden?
Well. Let's put it a little more nuance than that, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of wild ecosystems will not survive in their current form, right? And I emphasize the in their current form part of it. We're not moving into sort of either or situation. You know, some people think of, they talk about climate change. There's a bunch of people out there talk about climate change as this unmitigated disaster, right? It's total apocalypse. It's over. We're toast. Forget about it. We're all going to die. There's that kind of doomist narrative out there. And then there's another kind of narrative of, things are changing a little bit, but, you know, we can deal with it. So what? You know, that's another one of the many sort of climate narratives that goes out there. And what I'm saying is, what my looking at this, and, you know, again, I've been this old-fashioned naturalist my whole life. I've been fascinated by wild creatures. I've traveled to a lot of places. I've spent a lot of time looking at them, reading about them. You know, what I'm seeing is a whole lot of ecosystems are going to change. And for a lot of those ecosystems, the change is going to be tough because it's going to make them a lot less stable and a lot less diverse. I'm seeing a future in which a lot of species go extinct and the world overall loses diversity and loses this richness that, you know, our species has grown up with. But I also think that it's not an either or situation. We're not like completely doomed. The less CO2, the less global warming pollution, to use Al Gore's phrase, that we throw into the air, the less impact we're having, the less chance we have of these mass extinctions, the less chance we have of these catastrophic impacts, the fewer extinctions we're going to see, right? So this basically, climate change plays out on a kind of weird, bumpy continuum. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, we're facing a really tough situation right now. I'm seeing a lot of bad stuff happening all around the world. But if we take our foot off the gas, literally, and stop throwing all this pollution into the atmosphere, we can radically reduce the chances of these impacts, you know, becoming, you know, a hell of a lot worse. So again, it's not either or. It's like there's great importance to act really fast and really intelligently. Every bit of action buys you some time, right? Every bit of action buys you a chance of a better outcome. But right now, what I'm seeing, the effects that I'm seeing right now, things are really, really bad in a lot of places. And there's no sugarcoating that.
Adam Veltz, I can't thank you enough. You've really broken it down in ways that I think those of us who are not naturalists or scientists or see what you've seen really can appreciate. The book is called The End of Eden, Wild Nature in the Age of Climate Breakdown. I thank you so much for joining us from South Africa today and for all the work that you continue to do on our behalf. Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks so much for having me.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.